I haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, no. Oh,
are we telling everybody that I haven't seen Star Wars and that's what I'm doing during
No, you said that part. I stopped before then. All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to our podcast, Everything That Rises, a podcast about the short stories of the one and only Miss Flannery O'Connor. My name is John Meehan. I'm an English teacher, an author, a speaker, a writer, a presenter, an instructional coach, and a word nerd. And so every week I hang out with people who are just as nerdy or cooler than me, and we talk about the short stories of the one and only Flannery O'Connor, who is amazing. And to do it today, I invited one of my amazing friends who lives very south, and I'm very upset that she lives very south, but she lives in Richmond, Virginia, dialing all the way in, my good friend Julia Struckley. Julia, do you want to say hey?
Hi. Hello.
That's it.
It's good to be here.
We're not famous. Julia, you want to tell the world a little bit about yourself before we get started into today's story?
Sure. I am also a teacher. I teach here in Richmond. I teach middle school. I also have a bachelor's in media studies and a master's in theology from Catholic University, which is where I met John many years ago. We won't say how many years ago, but a fair amount of time.
And both of us, that's not English. Both of us, this teaching thing is not actually our first career. We were both things before that, so we're even older than we sound on the internet.
But we started teaching at the same time, which is kind of cool. We fell into it at the same time, yeah.
I won't say how many years ago that was.
Right.
It was a while. So, we came to it by happenstance, by luck, and just, you know, maybe by fate or providence. There it is. But today we're talking about a short story by Flannery O'Connor, which my rule for guests is always like that you pick him. So I gave you a list. I said, what do you want to do? And you picked
Circle in the Fire.
All right. And I want to talk about this. First impression. So you've read stuff by Flannery O'Connor before this short story, correct?
Yes. In undergrad, I had to read A Good Man is Hard to Find, but it has been, like I said, a minute. We're not going to say how long again, but it's been a minute. So to reread it has been cool. And this one just like stood out to me. I'd heard good things about it. And it was between this one and The River, but I decided to go with this one because of the scriptural elements. And I teach scripture. Yeah, I teach scripture. So
and you've taught in the high school too. So like you actually have a whole bunch of like not just – you know, I think I understand it, but like you kind of get paid to understand it.
I mean, I think I understand it, but yeah, I also get paid to understand it. And yeah, I taught high school for 5 years and now I've been teaching. Well, now I'm saying how long it's been.
Okay, man.
And I've been in middle school for 5 years, but I teach scripture and I've taught scripture for that amount of time.
Let me ask you a question because you are in Richmond, which is the erstwhile capital of the Confederacy.
You went there already. We're talking about it.
I have Richmond. I have a lot of places in my world that are now on my dead to me list.
I know.
But I find that the South, I'm from New Jersey originally, the South is very different. It's a palpable difference. For me, as a person who's from the North, you're not originally from the South. You're from Ohio.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I'm a transplant too. So, I mean, I was definitely raised Northerner, but I've dabbled in the South. I lived in Louisville, Kentucky, fun fact, for a few years growing up. And now I've found myself back South. But yeah, I lived in D.C., where you're located for a very long time. And Richmond's still kind of new to me, but I like the vibe. It's got that old school vibe for sure. You have pockets of it, but then there's a lot of artists down here, a lot of up and coming kind of changes, a lot of cool movements that are happening too, but you do feel those ties. And I think right now we're talking about maybe some changes that could be made, but people are definitely like holding on to the roots as well. So it's an interesting time to live down here for sure.
That's really well said. And I think that the South is just different from the North. You know, I joked in another podcast that the North won the Civil War because we just are more blunt and more direct and talk to the point. I think what Flannery O'Connor does so well issues very direct, very blunt. And a lot of times that Southern sensibility has a hard time kind of computing that. And I think that sort of sets the table nicely for this story, which is like standing on ceremony and standing on sensibility so we don't offend anybody, but then like bad things happen.
Right.
As they are wont to do.
I mean, I'm a straightforward kind of girl as well, as you know. And so I love that about her. But I do think there's a ton of symbolism as well, which I'm sure that you picked up on and love as well. So even though it's very straight to the point and there's definitely some things she hits you over the head with, I think there's things worth delving into as well, symbolically.
All right, let's go then.
Okay.
So, Fire, a short story from Flannery O'Connor, which is set in, I want to say Georgia. Let's say Georgia.
Yeah, it's Georgia.
Almost always Georgia.
Right.
Do you want to give like a crash course version of like a drive-by of what the story is about before we go into any two specifics?
I can give you a little summary. Yeah. So we have two women where the scene kind of opens, and Mrs. Cope is the owner, the landowner. Mrs. Pritchard works for her. But they, I'm assuming, are about the same age just based on the way that they're written, but they're complete opposites. So Mrs. Pritchard is kind of the gossip. She opens on like talking about, we'll have to talk about what she, I have so many things about what she says, but she's kind of the town gossip, talking about really kind of morbid and, you know, straightforward things. And then Mrs. Cope is more about airs, and she doesn't want to like, you know, she's very much about appearances. She doesn't want to delve into the reality that Miss Pritchard just kind of hits her with. And then there's another, she's just referred to as the child for a good portion of this story, but but then she is introduced later, and we can assume that she is Mrs. Cope's child that lives there with her. And then there are three strangers that kind of three boys that happen upon the two women in Mrs. Cope's land. And then it kind of takes off from there.
It does take off from there.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good way to, that was very spoiler free. I dig it.
Hey.
So no, that was exactly what we wanted.
Do what I can.
We only have like six listeners, and if they get spoiled out of it, they're like, well, now I'm not going to read it. So now's your chance. Pause.
Well, I figured we'll dive in. We'll dive in and get into more of it, you know, but that's the overview.
But this is like your last warning, like spoilers, there be spoilers ahead.
Exactly.
All right. So here we go. So, and what we'll typically do is we'll break this in about two episodes. So if you're new to the podcast, we'll take about 45 minutes on the first half of A Circle in the Fire. It is available legally and otherwise on the internet. You can find it in the time of a shutdown or a lockdown or a pandemic, or you can find it in the collected stories of Flannery O'Connor. It is amazing. And I think for me, it's a very accessible story. It's also not a very long one.
Yeah, that's also kind of why I picked it, not going to lie.
Oh, I see. It's, now the truth comes out. All right, but here we are, Circle in the Fire. We're set, and we get to know about these characters who have like a very southern thing. Like they're the gossiping, they're like the town, the talkabouts. And we have Mrs. Pritchard and a Mrs. Cope. And if I'm talking about like symbolism and names, her name is Mrs. Cope.
Right.
It's not like Mrs. Hope or like Mrs. Happy or Mrs. like joyful. It's Mrs. Cope. Like, she puts up with it.
It's pretty literal. I mean, I made a lot of notes on her name. And I think that, she's coping in a very interesting way, kind of unhealthy way, I would say. But I know a lot, I feel like I know this character. I feel like I know a lot of women who, they're putting on airs and appearances, but deep down, you know, there's something that's just boiling over, you know?
I agree. And the more and more I read Flannery O'Connor's short story, she's very ahead of her time. Like there's this meme culture right now that has adopted this Karen who wants to speak to your manager. But like, I feel like this middle-aged woman who is from like an older generation, just before ours, like, of course her name would be Karen. Why wouldn't it be Karen? You know, it's like someone who's very middle of, and that it's Mrs. Cope. That's a very like, you don't know whether it's like Welsh or Cornish or English kind of last name, but it's nothing like a famous Catholic kind of name. So it is.
Well,
like
actually, I dipped into the like Latin Catholic roots because, of course, I did some of the theology girl. So like a cope, John, in like vestments, like the garbs that the priest wears, it's like it's an outer, it's kind of like a cape, and it's used so that like you don't touch like sacred items. So like when the Eucharist is present and stuff, like they wear a cope like during Eucharistic adoration.
Okay. Now
I'm saying all these things that people probably don't have any context for.
But no, that's super cool.
So like, it's a Catholic thing that a priest wears to make
right.
It really
so when
simple.
We do communion in the Catholic Church, like they hold up the bread, we call it the Eucharist, like the body, the wafer, we hold it up. And there's a scene in here when they're in the kitchen where they hold up a dish that kind of reminds me of the Eucharist. But a cope,
so it's like an outermost like garment that's like, it's very kind of like, I don't know, just so that
it's like a snuggie.
It's okay. Yeah. But it's this idea that like they can't touch it. Like it's like humility, right? And I just feel like that is very fitting for her that she just like doesn't want to dive in. She doesn't want to touch it. You know, it's guarded.
I stand humbled and corrected. So I felt like Pritchard was very like generic middle of like could be from England, from Wales, from anywhere. And then I was like, cope. Yeah, it doesn't sound like it's Italian or Irish or Polish or, you know, Hispanic. So I'm going to go
Latin.
Ahead. And
I think it is. Yeah. But I don't, again, I mean,
Flannery O'Connor's diehard like Vatican I Catholic, so that would add up that she would know that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Look, I'm going to edit this so it sounds like I knew that all along. So anyways, so Mrs. Cope is hanging out with Mrs. Pritchard, and we mentioned that one of them is a – that's something else that Flannery O'Connor does unapologetically, like body shamey here. She mentions
right?
Mrs. Pritchard with her arms folded on a shelf of stomach.
Right? I wrote down that they're opposites, and like literally I wrote like Mrs. Pritchard, fat, and yep. then Mrs. Cope, thin.
Yes.
And I mean – yeah, so this is one of the moments where she just kind of hits you over the head. There's no...
I don't disagree with that. There's also this scene of... And this happens in a lot of Flannery O'Connor. When there's like a two female characters, mm-hmm. one is the main character we're supposed to like... I don't necessarily say sympathy towards, but the spotlight is shining most brightly on.
Uh-huh.
But that second character is usually a little bit more shrewd, a little bit more discerning, and like not realizing what's about to... Like the main character doesn't see what's about to happen. It's that second character who's like eyebrow up, like, I wouldn't do that.
And that's exactly what I think she serves here. So I didn't realize that was like a trope for O'Connor, but yeah.
I've been doing totally a lot. I don't have much else to do. So yeah, I realized I should have picked like maybe a happier author like J.K. Rowling or something.
No, nope, this is totally time appropriate. So if we're going to just talk right at the beginning, then like, on that first page of the story, like the thing that Mrs. Pritchard is gossiping about is like, did you hear about that woman that had the child and the iron lung? And yeah. that kind of like hit me over the head too, because we're in this, you know, isolated state right now and with ventilators and like breathing and all of these things. So that was very like shocking to me right away. So obviously this is taking place. Like,
it was shocking. And I was listening to a video right before we went on air. Bishop Barron is doing this really cool video series on like famous Catholics, because why not? It's Lent. And mm-hmm. in it, he talks about Flannery O'Connor as like the great storyteller of the 1950s, like the middle of the 20th mm-hmm. century. And he mentions like the responsibility of a Catholic author, of course he's Catholic, so he would get paid to say this, but like, he's like, is to tell the truth first and foremost, not the truth in the way we want it to be, but the truth in the way that it is. And not in a shallow kind of realism, like we describe things accurately, but in describing them accurately, we're sort of pointing to deeper truths that are like leading to something. And I think that's interesting here and powerful, because these women, like you said, I agree. I feel like I know them. I feel mm-hmm. like I've met them before.
Mm-hmm. And it just definitely sets the stage for like the time period. And I mean, obviously this is, like you said, in the 40s and the 50s, and they were dealing with polio. So this would have been a thing. And I just thought it was interesting how here we are, like however many years, decades later.
I was struck though. I mean, I'm reminded of that awful scene in the first Kill Bill movie. And there's some grotesque there too, right? Where like they're talking about the bride character there is in like a persistent vegetative state. And we believe her to be like dead. And the movie starts. Without spoiling it, she's going to kill Bill, but doesn't start that way. But when she's locked up in a hospital, like it's this scene where in the beginning it says, you know, she was 4 months before even she got that way. Looked like to me, I wasn't even one of them. How would they leave off? How do you reckon they're asking about the manner by which this woman in an iron lung came to be pregnant? Mm-hmm. And that's like very tawdry, very grotesque, like very tiptoeing up to the line of like, it's not your business to know that information. And yet it seems like it's almost like sensationalist or exploitative. This is like kind of what passes the time.
Totally. But and awkward. Mrs. Pritchard is all about that sensationalism. It seems like, you know, she just goes in. And then Miss Cope is the opposite. So she's like kind of hesitant and she doesn't really want to be, listening to what Miss Pritchard has to say. She doesn't want to go there. So I think, mm-hmm. So we've set the stage that they are both very opposite physically.
But I'm bothered by in the beginning of this, because like I'm on that page 2, page 3 of my story. And again, we're not looking at, we're bad teachers. We're not using the same version of the text. Should have done that. But maybe 4 or 5 paragraphs in, Mrs. Cope is afraid that someone will accidentally light her woods on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so while she's afraid that the woods are going to catch on fire, she turns her head and sees that what she calls her Negro, not like the Negro who worked mm-hmm. there, but her Negro. So there's like a sense of class and entitlement there.
Well, everything is hers. I mean, that's kind of comes up a lot. Like everything, and later on, you know, the other guys will point it out too. But yeah, everything is hers,
up to including the sky above her land, which is mm-hmm. wild. You know, like who owns what? But the wagon is bouncing along, and they're kind of mowing the grass. And her Negro, she says, goes around the long way just to spite her rather than just lifting up the mower blades and going through the gate. So she gets upset, but rather than shouting after like this person who she believes is like her property or her servant. And I understand it's post-Civil War, so it's not her slave, but she still kind of thinks of this person like they belong to her.
And if I can be a scripture nerd again for a second, like that idea of going through the gate, you know, in the New Testament, there's that idea of like having to go through the narrow gate, and that's like the correct way to go to heaven.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like for me, like I think there's a lot of undertones here. Like she wants to be very pious.
Yes.
And she is not as pious as she thinks she is. But I think she wants to, again, that put on that air that she is pious. So she's upset that he didn't go through the gate.
I completely agree. And right? I think that too, that stratification, that idea of like, you know, many are called, but like the eye of the needle, like the rich people, the landowners getting into heaven, it's like, it's very hard for them to do that because they have so much, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in this scene, she sees her Negroes are going the wrong way. So she says, she doesn't shout to the black man because that's like not becoming of her.
Right.
She tells Mrs. Pritchard, tell him to stop and come here.
Because she's like, the more like uncouth one that she can, yeah, right, she can do right, that. Like, she has license, you know, to do that.
Get out there and just wave your arms around, you know, like fat lady, go wave your fat arms around these poor black people. Because there's a level of like entitlement that's like, no, I'm all seeing, all knowing, and I'm in a better spot. Like I'm the skinny one, I'm the pulled together one, I'm the one who has money. You and the rest of the hoi polloi will go yell at each other. That's what you do. And it seems as if there's like a really smart detail in here. When she calls after quote, her Negroes, who she believes are as destructive as impersonal as nutgrass, she says that the one who comes up to the doorway, she says he's pushing his head and shoulders forward at each step to give the appearance of hurrying. But like, it's pretty clear that she runs her mouth, and Culver here has been called up a million times, and he's like, nope, not doing that. So he just makes it look like, yeah, I'm on my way. But he's really just, mm-hmm. he's playing her, right?
Yeah. No, a lot of them are playing her for sure. Yeah, they're on to her.
Real quick. And she says, you know, when she asks him, so why aren't you going through the gate? Her eyes shut and her mouth stretched flat as if she were prepared for any ridiculous answer. Like, and I think this is an early character reveal. And I think in reading a lot of O'Connor, what I'm seeing is like, it's these people who are outward seeming, but they're inward being. Like, they want to pretend like they've given you a chance for grace and redemption and like apology. But behind that, they pretty much made up their mind. Like, this is the teacher who calls you in to explain yourself, young man. But they
she does that as well. Totally. And I feel like, yeah, it's a pride and like vanity. And I think false piety are much themes in what I can remember from O'Connor as well. And so, you know, Mrs. Cope embodies all of that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And so she says, you know, after she scolds her servant, she says, you know, well, it's nothing to them. They don't have responsibility. But I thank the Lord all these things don't come to me at once. Oh my, they would destroy me. Like,
and that kind of hit me too. I feel again, like in this moment where all of us are kind of going through a similar thing, but at, you know, different degrees and different levels. It's easy to make those comparisons and stuff. And she also reminds me of a scripture character where like one of the high priests is praying in the temple and he's like, oh, thank God you didn't make me like that person over there, that poor person that's praying in the temple as well. And I think that it's just really easy to get caught up in comparisons. And she very much is doing that. Like, I'm very glad you didn't make me like that. I'm glad I don't have those problems. I wouldn't be able to handle it, you know?
I fully agree with you. And because I'm Catholic, I don't actually know the gospel so good. Because I wait for the priest to read them. Thank you. I appreciate it. But like, I was in Godspell, darn it. And Godspell is based on the Gospel of Matthew. And that's one of the scenes that I've
only one you know. Remember. Yeah.
Do you remember that
scene? Is that in Godspell? I actually have not like, seen Godspell, which is shocking.
I have it on VHS. When we're allowed to unquarantine, if you just
play it up. That's exactly what I want to do as soon as we're not quarantined, is watch Godspell
on VHS. It's me in it. No, now you're interested. Not me. It's a whole bunch of people that went to Catholic with, and we're in a school production of Godspell. But there it is. And I'll delete this part too, so it makes it sound like... I'll add laughter in, so it sounds like you're really excited about this. But no, and there's a scene where the high priest is up there and he's like, mm-hmm. you know, oh, have mercy on, you know, me, God, you know, thank God that I'm not this right. sinner. I'm not like Lazarus. Yeah. I'm not this poor guy. Blah, 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 blah. And it's like, be careful.
You know the gospel. You even know whose the name was. That's great.
I was in Godspell. I mean, like, it was a line from a show. I think it's important. So I said to somebody the other day, I was talking about Flannery O'Connor and like the brilliance of the literature. And she's like, you know, you're a good Catholic because you understand Flannery O'Connor. I'm like, I don't know if that's true. I think I understand her stories, but that doesn't I understand the mysteries of faith that kind of come behind that. And I think she's leading you there, but she's giving you the chance to have these encounters with grace. But she says in her letters too, she's like, most of my stories are about opportunities for grace that are refused. And I think that for me is eye-opening and powerful, because that's what we're about to see in the story, as these characters are led to moments where they should have their eyes opened.
And I think it makes her work more universal too, the fact that she's not just like, you know, she is being very straightforward, but you don't necessarily have to have that background to understand her points and her stories, you know.
Upvote. I completely agree. So here we have this woman saying she's going to say her prayers for Thanksgiving every day. You know, do you say your prayers?
She wants to make sure everyone else is saying their prayers too.
Very clearly and very quickly. Bless their hearts. God bless them. Like, it's very Southern. It's very sensible. It's very, you know, whatever it is like that. And this is Pritchard, who's, again, dwelling on the grotesque, you know, thinking about women in iron lungs and people, like, dying.
Right. Goes,
all I got is four abscessed teeth. Derp, derp, derp. And then Mrs. Cope's like, well, she doesn't say derp, derp, derp. I added that part in. But that was, well, but I heard.
There's the line where she's like, get off, I told you.
So I would imagine a derp, derp, like, she strikes me as a very Jerry Springer type caricature of a woman in the South. I think Mrs. Cope is handled with a little bit more grace, a little bit more, like, even self-imbued dignity. But Mrs. Pritchard is a very broadly drawn caricature of a Southern, like, I would say just below working class level.
Sure.
In other stories, Flannery O'Connor uses the phrase white trash. But, like, I didn't say that. She said that. but she says, you know, all I got is four abscessed teeth. And then Mrs. Cope tries to save the day. Well, be thankful you don't have five.
Yeah, you know, like, it's too much. It's too much.
Oh, man. So I want to talk to you, though, about a thing that I spotted in here. And it was only my fourth read through, because that's what I do.
Wow.
When I caught it. This is why we are friends, Julia.
Well, I took a ton of notes. Like, I have three pages of notes typed up here, single space. So this is how I studied for comps. Yeah.
All right, there it is. Let's go. Mr. Cope says, well, be thankful you don't have five. She snaps and throws away a clump of grass. You know, we might all be destroyed by a hurricane. I can always find something to be thankful for. In that scene, I'm thinking of a biblical parallel. And tell me if I'm off base. Like,
okay, all right.
But I remember Old Testament, because when I went to Sunday school, because I was a public school kid, so I had to do, like, the Sunday school to learn about, like, the Bible stories. We didn't get them in public school. Like, I guess Noah deals with, like, the flood, right?
Sure. And that's correct.
Like, a big storm, right? Allegedly, right? You know, two by two and whatever's like that. But then after the flood, Noah has, like, a covenant with God. He's like, hey, I promise I'm not going to destroy the world by flooding again. Mm-hmm. You know, pinky swear from Jesus. We're good. Okay. He's like, but just kidding. I'm going to burn it to hell next time. Ha, 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 ha. Like, God made him a deal. Like, thanks. No more flood. Sounds amazing. But this scene here, it says we might all be destroyed by a hurricane. But a hurricane is a water-based, like, a natural disaster. Her fear, and major spoiler, like, this circle of fire is not a water destruction, but it's a coming plague that is, you know, one of immolation, one of fire. Do you buy
it? So are you saying that she's, like, she's cool with the flood? Like, she's ready for the flood, but she's not cool with the fire?
It's exactly that. It's very...
Well, because...
Go ahead.
The water is symbolic, again, in the faith, and that it's cleansing. Yes, it's powerful and destructive, but, you know, that's what provides grace, right? The baptism, the water. So maybe that's why she's cool with it. But I didn't pick up on that. That was good.
Yeah, I spotted that. And I think it's too, like, it's very Old Testament versus New Testament, like, covenant. Yeah. Like, Revelations ends with spoiler,
fire.
Like, the fire. Like, and this whole thing, like, both can be cleansing, you know, like, you know, a wildfire can, like, burn away all the old stuff. But I think that's it, is that this woman has, I think it's that other biblical, I know a lot more Bible than I thought I did.
At this, I'm bringing it out of you. And there's no denying the fire. The fire is definitely hell. We know that. That's like, there's no denying it. But
there's that line about, you know, like, be vigilant, stay alert. If the master had known when the thieves were coming, he wouldn't have, like, fallen asleep. Like, her house is about to be invaded by four thieves or four robbers or four people who are, like, up to no good. And, like, she doesn't see it coming because she's thinking only about water.
Yeah, totally.
So she doesn't see the fire imagery. Kind of. And again, she mentions earlier that she's afraid of the woods catching on fire, but anyways. So as they wrap up this scene.
I like that.
Buy it. Good. As an English teacher, if you just say it, like, loud enough and assertive enough, people start to believe that it was on purpose.
There's tons of symbols in here, and at some point we can come back to it, but I'm really curious from your English teacher's perspective about the colors of, like, the hats and the garments and things, so we can come back to that. But
I am so in for this. I also
I know you love your green light and your Gatsby and all that.
All right.
So I picked up a little bit on that here.
Ain't no party like a Gatsby party, because a Gatsby party don't stop until three people are dead and everyone's just losing to the 1920s.
I don't want to be at that party.
No. But, and then everyone to this day is like, let's throw a Gatsby themed party. I'm like, you have read the book, right?
I know.
Anyways, getting back to this story, sorry. She's very happy with her house. She says, I have the best kept place in the county. And you know why? Because I work. I've had to work and save this place and work to keep it. And in fairness, to her point, she is on her hands and knees when we first meet her working. She is toiling. Like, she is doing a little bit of, like, the light yard work. She's not, like, out in the fields, but she is doing some work. And it seems as if she's a single mom raising her daughter, yet to be named, though she does hire people to work for her, right? You know, like Baby Yoda, she does have the child. Oh, wait, you didn't get that. You didn't watch
Mandalorian. I haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, no. Oh, man.
Are we telling everybody that I haven't seen Star Wars and that's what I'm doing?
No, you said that part. I stopped before then. All right. But she says, I think I'm in good shape. You know, I don't let anything get ahead of me. I'm fine. I'll take it as it comes. As long as it doesn't come all at once, Mrs. Pritchard says. And Mrs. Cope repeats. It's the second time she said it. It doesn't all come at once. And then, like, as if on cue...
Yep, there they go. Here they come.
Boom. You have a pickup truck, stop at the gate, and three boys show up on a pink dirt road. They walked a single file, like sand people, to hide their numbers. The middle one bent to the side.
I know that reference now. I know
there it was. There it is. There it is.
Took me a minute.
I'm going to make the whole thing Flannery O'Connor Star Wars. The middle one bent in the side, carrying a black pig-shaped valise. What did you make of this when you read this and now these three?
Okay, so I'm going to throw a theory out to you, and you can tell me, because I was like dying to when I saw the three visitors. Okay. So in Genesis 18 and 19, there are three visitors that go, three angels that go to visit Abraham, who, right, is like the founding father of all the monotheistic religions. So they come up to Abraham and he like makes them a meal. Okay.
Yes.
And then they have this message. They say that they're Sarah's going to have the baby, and they laugh. And so then they kind of are like, well, we don't know if we should tell you more information. And they're going to go and destroy Sodom, ultimately, these three visitors. And they do end up telling Abraham that. But it's kind of this whole thing. And so when I heard the three visitors or like read the three visitors, I'm like, is this like God? And then later, obviously, they're not, you know, they're not super holy and perfect themselves. But at first I was like, oh, these three visitors, like, have they come to like tell her that, you know, just to kind of like call her out and be like, look, you think you're holy, you think you're pious, but like, we're here to tell you and to show you that this is what real piety is. I don't know. That's what I got.
Wow.
You didn't get that? Your Old Testament? No.
I have to get it. I can't say no. That adds. That tracks, right?
That's where my head went. There's other Old Testament stories too. I mean, three is definitely in, and there's so many symbolic numbers in the Old Testament, and three obviously is a divine Trinitarian number. So the three visitors are said to be like God, essentially, when they go to Abraham and tell him all these things. But yeah, Abraham pulls out all the stops and wants to like wine and dine them. And then they're there to kind of like warn him about where his nephew lives in Sodom. And so I feel like I kind of got that vibe. But
does Abraham serve them guinea? Because that's what you're
doing. No, but the fatted calf, he makes bread, yeah. They have milk, they have a feast. So like, I mean, okay. Going to go back to the story, Miss Cope really wants to feed them.
She does.
She's like constantly feeding them. So we can
talk about
that.
Very Southern thing too. Like, I can't do much, but I can feed you. Like, y'all come in for a nice meal. I don't know. My brain went to the story of Nebuchadnezzar. And
yeah, that too. Yeah.
People. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was to me maybe the more obvious one. So I don't have the deep tracks Catholicism.
Well, at the end, I mean, when we get there, the end, there's definitely that like Daniel reference for sure. Yeah.
And that idea about, you know, talking about Daniel in the lion's den, that's a very familiar story that many people would know about. But like, I remember there's some liturgy hours or something where I've heard the names of like the three.
You're
men
throwing out all the Catholic stuff now. Liturgy of the Hours.
I have a lot.
I don't think your listeners are ready for all of the Catholic.
This should come with a spoiler. Like you need to have at least you know 3 years.
You need to know what a cope is. You need to know what liturgy.
We're doing a good job of explaining.
We're doing a great job.
If I was new at this, and I'm not, but no, there's that story about like, was it Shadrach, Meshach?
Yep.
And
Abednego.
Okay, there it is.
Yeah. Gesundheit, you're welcome. Yeah.
There it is, Abednego, right? And yeah. they get the evil king, throws him into the pit, and he's like, haha, screw you. And they're like, haha, we're fireproof. And he's like, no, you're not. And he's like, yeah, watch this. And then he's so, by the end, so terrified and so like, you know, aware that he's like, oh my God, I have totally screwed up. And he I think, winds up being converted.
I mean, that totally is the story at the end for sure. So I think we're going to get there.
Okay, got it. Yeah, if it doesn't come all at once, you see these three boys who show up
visitors.
Yeah. Right, the visitors.
But she doesn't recognize him. And that's the thing, too, that, like, they're supposed to be familiar. At least one of them is supposed to be familiar to her. And he's like, don't you remember me? And I feel like that's where the God stuff comes in, where I was getting at. Like, it's kind of like God reminding her, like, don't you remember me? Don't you remember what I'm really about? Like, what you're really supposed to do? I don't know. They're kind of bringing that out of her.
So the three boys look something alike, except for the middle one wore silver-rimmed spectacles and carried a suitcase. Now, they're at about age 13, we're going to say, which is weird, but it's only weird by, like, today's standards. Back in the 1950s.
Is that what they did? They hung out and just...
You know, have you seen, like, The Sandlot or, like, Stand By Me, Stephen King? It's like, you want to show your dead body? Derp, derp, derp. Like,
derp again. There's the derp.
Like, they just go and hang out with, like, I got nothing to do. It's like... Latchkey kids, raise yourselves. You'll figure it out.
Yeah, no, you're right. Totally.
And that was, like, not as weird, like, to have kids come and, like, you know, wandering, drink from your troughs and, you know, ride on your horses, whatever it's like that. But the fact that one wears spectacles is, to me, huge, right? Because there's some wisdom, there's some second sight that he has. Mm. And, like, the idea of glasses come up on a lot of Flannery O'Connor's short stories. And A Good Man Is Hard to Find, the misfit wears glasses until he, spoiler, executes the grandmother, then takes his glasses off and has to rub them clean. In Good Country People, Manly Pointer, who's the Bible salesman, steals the wooden leg of the girl named Hulga, and he takes her glasses before he takes her wooden legs. He takes her sight before he takes her body. So there's a lot of sight imagery that kind of comes through with O'Connor with glasses.
And that's just like a lot of literature. I mean, I know, again, to reference some books that I know you love, Gatsby with the billboard, and then also The Wizard of Oz. Wizard of Oz with the...
I mean, everything written
every literature,
T.S. Eliot,
glasses,
the all-seeing eyes of T.J. Eckelberg, of course, and Gatsby for sure. But so he takes his eyes off, or he takes his eyes and he looks around, and it sees as if from his gaze, it looks as if he has them surrounded. Here's a clue: like they talk about the wall of trees far away from the this plantation-style house, this farm, feels like a fortress, like it's safe over there. But this kid's look, with one look, it looks like he has the whole place surrounded. I don't know if that's because he has a wandering eye or lazy eye, or because that's the look, like there's something unseemly about this scene here.
So I've proposed, and my opinion changed when I got closer to the end, but do you think that they represent some kind of, I mean, they definitely represent spiritual elements, but do you think it's good? Do you think it's evil? Do you think it's...
I think Flannery O'Connor rejects black and whites always, and that's awesome. Because
so it's
like
a little bit
of bad people who can put you in a place that, even though they are bad people, they can point you to the salvation that you...
Yeah, and that's exactly what... Yeah.
And I think that this thing is just, Boyd, she said, your father was Mr. Boyd and you're JC? Like, oh, here we go, heavy-handed symbolism. Huh, if he has a son named JC, who could it be? Like... We have very clear Christ figures throughout much of the Southern Gothic. I mean, like, Boo Radley is a Christ figure, you know? I mean, like, you have a lot of characters who, even if they're fallen or broken or twisted in some way, have a chance to lead you back to some sort of salvation. Because this boy, who's not JC, his name is Powell.
And again, she can never remember their names. Like she's butchering their names. She just calls them kind of what she wants to. I think there's something where it's like his name is Ashfield and she calls him Garfield or the opposite. And again, like she doesn't recognize them. She calls them what she wants. She doesn't remember their names. So like clearly I think, you know, it's pointing out how far away she's gotten from what reality is and from what the real Christian purpose is.
You know, I think that's really a good point. And I'm reminded of a story of a friend of mine who was like not taken care of, but like going to work every day. And he saw a person who was homeless, begging for money. And like after a while, like guilt kind of set in and he started just like buying food for this person, which is, you know, very kind. At one point or another, the man just took the food after like weeks of being given food and just threw it at him. And he's like, what the hell, man? I give you food every day. He's like, you never stop to ask my name. You don't sit here to have a conversation with me. You go through the thing that alleviates your guilt, but you never get to know me as a person. And I think that this is that. Like,
right, because she's constantly trying to feed them. She's like, what? Take the food. Isn't that what you want? I know they're hungry. I think she says that. She's like, I know they're hungry. I just know it. And that's not what they need. And that's not what she needs. But she is not willing to recognize that because she thinks she knows best. And
yeah. this is actually now I kind of feel sad. But like, again, now I feel bad for these kids, and I don't think she necessarily wants me here to feel bad for them, because that's the thing that would make me say, well, then I'll get them some food.
Yeah, I got so wrapped up in the visitors part with the Genesis. Like, I just, so I really at the beginning, I'm like, oh, they are the Christ figures. And then you're pointing out like the JC initials. I'm like, yeah, they're totally the, you know, the God. But then as you pointed out, without black and white, you know,
right.
So I don't think that they are that literal, but
no.
But I think they are there to show her kind of like what your friend's story is, that Christianity isn't just about what we think people need. It's really going at the heart of it and trying to get to the heart of the person. Meeting them where they're at, you know. Well, she's not trying to meet them.
And you said earlier too, like, you don't have to be Catholic to read Flannery O'Connor. You don't have to be Christian. It helps to understand that this author is Christian. So she's borrowing against, like, you know, a lot of Christian tradition, a lot of Catholic thought for sure. But there's
be a good person. Like, don't be a jerk.
Don't be a jerk. I'm gonna keep it PG because it's a family friendly podcast.
Okay, got it.
Don't be a jerk, right? You know, like, don't be that guy. So we meet these kids, Garfield Smith, W.T. Harper, and one of Powell's eyes seems to be making a circle around them.
He's all seeing. He's all knowing. I like it.
There it is. He's just like, he's got this dead eye, and that even is more on brand for Southern Gothic. And they talk about, they ignored Mrs. Pritchard, who was watching with beady eyes, steady staring eyes. And they all just seem to hang there, like almost like vultures, just watching Mrs. Cope, waiting until she says something or does something. And they're like, out of nowhere, like awkward pause. They're like, so I hear you have horses and kind of want to ride them. I don't know.
I was thinking, what is the modern day equivalent? And because these boys really do just get like very fixed on the horses. And I'm like, what is it about these horses? But you're talking about like, this is, you know, latchkey era.
Right.
They didn't have video games. Now it's like, oh, I hear you have, I don't play video games. So like, whatever the latest gaming system is. Let's get to that.
To the end. I want to see where you go with the latest video game you can think of. Go ahead, please.
I mean, I played Nintendo when I was a kid.
There we go.
I wasn't allowed to have one, but that's my last reference. So,
all right, done. But yeah, so like, they want to come and, like, I don't know, take her car for a joyride or take their horses out for a stretch, right? And again, because the story is juxtaposing like the fat one and the skinny one. There's the fat boy, I think his name's Garfield, and then there's the skinny one who has a mouth on him. That's the other boy, the smaller one. And they're like looking around while poor Powell, who's there in the middle, Harper's super skinny. Garfield's super fat, like Garfield the fat cat who likes my lasagna. And, you know, it's very clear that Powell, she holds him to a different standard than the other two boys. She sees them as troublemakers. Like, one is the fat kid with the tattoo. One is like the small kid with the mouth. But she just looks at Powell like, well, I mean, we can't do that. You remember that, right? And you know the rules from here. You remember these days. But it seems as if this Powell kid has very fond memories of his time before his family moved down to Atlanta. And we're to understand that his family, I guess, moved off of the farm where they were like servant class.
Yeah.
And they became like tenement housing in Atlanta. And it sounds like his life now almost sucks more than when they were on the farm.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. But you're right. I mean, when she's talking, when he's like, don't you remember me? It was because that his family worked and lived, you know, on the land. And so and his father had told him all these stories about the horses. And so he's built up this, you know, I don't know, this kind of ideal of what the land should be, kind of this paradise a little bit, if we want to go there.
Yeah, I think that's expertly said. And he comes, or these kids come in, and they just want a chance to maybe
get away from,
Yeah, because they say you can't tell the difference between the houses except for the smell. Like, you can know your house by its own smell.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that pretty much tells you that they're stacked on top of each other, that like, it's just a very squalorous kind of, you know, very low income area. And just to get out, like, to hang out with the horses for the day is like a, not just a vacation, but like an upgrade to their day-to-day life. And so I think it's interesting when they say this line where she says, they were staring because they were hungry, !! Like, as if like it's come over her, you know, oh, duh, like here it is, like bolt out of the blue. For a second, I looked blank, then I blushed. Oh, right. Hunger, that's what people need. Like,
yeah.
I think about, I don't know, there's a Mother Teresa quote. She says, you know, first we feed them, then we clothe them, then if they ask, we tell them about Christ.
Right.
I feel like in this moment, she goes with her instinct, well, they must be hungry, which in some ways is good. She's not beating them over the head with the Jesus stuff. But we come to find out that her heart and her faith are actually not aligned with the Jesus stuff. And so she's reading into what she would want, her love language or her guilt language, right? And they looked as if they were used to being hungry, and it was no business of hers. They don't even particularly care to eat whatever she has to offer them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, we'll get to that. I think that's the later feeding. you're totally right. And I think your story, just again with your friend, the New Testament is very much about Jesus meeting people where they were at and knowing their need. And usually it's a much deeper spiritual need. And so she's just kind of going with the surface, whereas they need something a little bit deeper.
So let me do this thing, because we're right about the halfway mark, and I want to talk about it sort of to set the trap before we spring it in the second half here.
Okay.
The child upstairs grows red in the face with excitement. She's angry. She sees mom. She sees this whole thing unfolding. She's like, oh my God, mom, talking to people again. Like, it's every kid whose mom meets somebody in the supermarket and like rolls her eyes. What's want to be done here, right? So mom like sets up a space. There are three white lawn chairs, a red hammock between two hazelnut trees, more color symbolism. Meanwhile, the girl upstairs, again, just as a pale, fat girl of 12, frowning, squinting, mouth full of braces like silver bands. She's angry, and she wants this to be over. But meanwhile, Mrs. Cubs, well, these poor children are hungry. I'm reminded of the scene, if you give a mouse a cookie, like, don't do this. If you let them have food, they will stay. But it seems as if this daughter, who on this page we now learn the name is Sally Virginia, has very strong opinions maybe going the other way. I'm interested to hear your first take on, hot take on Sally Virginia.
Okay, so yeah. So I picked up on the fact that she was kneeling when she was observing all of the things that you just described. So she's kneeling down by the window, and she's looking, and she's got her forehead on the windowsill, just like peering. And I absolutely picked up on, she's got disdain for her mother. Like, you know, like any kind of 12, I'm assuming she's kind of the same age as the boys, like 12 or 13. And so it's hard to tell. I kind of initially was like, is she jealous that her mother is spending all this time, or is she like, she knows that her mom is up to no good, or that is, you know, not going to be, she's embarrassing herself in a way. Or she's excited to have visitors that are her age. That's kind of where my mind goes as we're setting the scene here.
Yeah, I didn't know. And I was struck that you mentioned that kneeling, because I think, and that's just now that you mentioned it, that she's kneeling now in the middle. I missed that part. I know that mom, when we first met mom, was kneeling, like doing a little bit of like trowel work, like by the sidewalk.
So I think Sally, she knows it's more, I think, personally. Right. Like, I think, you know, Mrs. Cope is just kneeling and going through the motions, whereas I think Sally knows that there's more. But Sally's only mentioned as Sally, like, one time throughout this.
Yep.
And then the story, I have my edition, my text that I have is in A Good Man, It's Hard to Find. And then the story right after that, A Late Encounter with the Enemy, also has a character named Sally in it. Do you know anything about Flannery O'Connor's obsession with the name Sally?
No, but I want to figure that out too, because Late Encounter of the Enemy is a fantastic story. Also, it's really racist.
I didn't want to go there, so I was like, I'm not gonna.
But the fact that this Sally's last name is Virginia, like, it's a reminder of the Confederacy. It's a reminder of, like, it's a
my
time and a pride
state.
Of place.
Yeah.
There it is. It's your adopted home state. You
it
can
is my
take
adopted
Ohio
home.
If you want it. I told somebody I was from D.C. one time, and they're like, you're not from D.C. I'm like, I am. They're like, no one's from D.C. unless they're, you know, really from somewhere else. I'm like, that's not true. They're like, people just say they're from D.C. because they've lived there, but they're actually embarrassed about where they were born. So where were you born? I was like,
New Jersey. There is some truth to that. I'm not going to totally validate it, but there's some truth to that. Yeah.
I have nothing further to say, except for that Bruce Springsteen reads him and loves him some Flannery O'Connor. So that's a true story. But this reminder of the Confederacy, this idea of Sally Virginia, I don't know where the Sally comes from. It may just be like a very popular woman's name. Like, Flannery O'Connor goes by Flannery. Her first name is Mary. So, like, it is one of those, oh, it's the 1950s, 1940s. There's very common names, Marie, Mary, you know, Sally. But Virginia as a middle name is a reveal about how Mrs. Cope, you know, values stuff. But I don't know. It's a great question, because right as we're about to hit the break, and this is a good point to kind of maybe like plot twist or spoiler coming up. As the boys are out there having food, the fat boy is described as the fat boy, stretched out in the hammock, has a cigarette and spits it out in an
arc.
Oh,
man, you know what's going to happen.
Oh, no. Oh, no. And of course, Mrs. Cope, given the wrong name, she's like, Ashfield, pick that up. I'm afraid of fires. And he's like, Garfield. Garfield. Like, his name isn't Ashfield, it's Garfield, and like I don't know. It feels like already she doesn't know a thing about him. She just wants to shout after him. She wants to tell him what to do, but doesn't want to listen to who he is and hear his story.
And she's afraid of the fire. I mean, he's got the fire.
And you think that's gonna?
She doesn't want it.
You think that's gonna end up poorly in the second half? When you read it.
I mean, as soon as that line that you just read, I mean, you know it's coming.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, I don't know. People might not tune in next week. Maybe it doesn't happen.
Have I spoiled it too much? I mean, circle in the fire. Circle in the fire.
Yeah, it's fair. Good point. All right. Well, then that's that for today. So, Julia, before we split for the day, we'll keep everybody in bated breath here at the midpoint of the story. I'm on Twitter at MeehanEDU, where I talk about literature and learning and all sorts of cool stuff. Are you on the Twitter machine?
I am on the Twitter machine. I've been on for a long time, but just recently, for teaching, I have a public account, Ms. Struckley, so MS, capital Struckely 1, and that's where you can find me.
Ooh, all right, and there's a capital S in there, which I'm sure actually doesn't matter on Twitter, but that's And that's great. So we'll be back here next week to talk more. If you want to talk more about literature, feel free to message Julia or myself. We want to say thank you guys for tuning in again. More of Circle in the Fire next week. If you want to be a guest on the podcast, message us. Yeah, we'd love to hang out, and we'll talk further. We'll hit the pause button for now, and we'll come back in 7 days. Thanks again. Bye for now.
Bye.